Hi, this is Matt Merton, and you're listening to Hanshin Tigers English News.
Yeah, Matt Merton is listening to Hanshin Tigers English News too, and so are you. Thank you so much for joining us on this podcast, episode number 50. It's a nice round number. It's a very special episode because, as you may have guessed, that was Matt Merton's voice, and you'll be hearing from him in just a little bit. In the meantime, today is Sunday, October the 2nd for us. It will soon be October the 3rd, which is happy birthday, Matt Merton. It's happy birthday, T-Ray's oldest son. But before we get into all the hoopla of birthdays and stuff, I'm T-Ray, and as co-host, I have got
good old Joe.
Good old Joe. You have been hanging out with us for a good long time. I love it. How you doing, man?
Not too bad. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing all right. I'm hanging in there. Parenting has taken on a whole extra angle and, you know, extra challenges. But doing what I can. Doing what I can to, you know, just keep on keeping on doing my best. So the good news is, at least for me, as far as a parent, is that the 2016 baseball season is over. We ended our schedule on Saturday, and so 143 games are done, and we are not playoff bound, so this is it. Joe, what did you feel like this year was to you as far as being a Hanshin fan?
Well, for me, being a part of this show is definitely a different year as being a Hanshin fan for me. I definitely have followed the team probably five times closer than I normally do, so it's been fun. Probably not the best year to decide to start doing that, but, you know, it's been good. You know, it was a tough year, but again, definitely a, you know, a positive year for rebuilding and giving guys time and finding some gems in the team. So, yeah, all in all, a good year, I think.
Yeah, I would definitely say so too. Like you said, you know, giving the young guys a chance and really, truly making this a rebuilding year, which Hanshin has been very bad at doing. So it's nice to see Kanemoto kind of, you know, stick to his guns and do that. For me, I really felt like the season kind of went in waves. And so the first couple months were really exciting. The next couple months were terrible. Then we had like actually a pretty good end of July and first 3/4 of August. And then we just went tank for another couple of weeks. And then these last couple of weeks have been pretty good. So it's really been like an up and down season as far as watching and cheering goes. As far as the analysis goes, this is far and away the most analysis I've done of the team since I started following them. You know, I have done a recap on every single series this year, which I wasn't able to do last year. I think I might have done about 3/4 of it. So, a real burden, but definitely a labor of love. And then also the podcast. You know, we did it from start to finish this year. And so I think at the start of the year we're on something like episode 22, and here we're on episode 50. So we've done like almost 30 episodes. During the season, every week. But yeah, pretty cool stuff. It's been a great season as far as that goes. And I'm excited for 2017 for the Hanshin Tigers and how they're going to improve and build on this year. That's right. Their record will be better next year. You can put me on record as saying that. What do you think, Joe? Do you think 2017 is going to be a pretty exciting year as well?
I think it has to be. I mean, there'll be definitely the expectations. They'll be like, okay, we've done our rebuilding. It's time to win the championship now.
Yes. Well, I hope they don't go into now or never desperation mode, but certainly, you know, they do want to get it done sooner than later. So, well, anyways, let us get into the show before we, you know, talk your ears off a little bit too much. So, Joe, I was able to actually chat with our buddy, Matt Merton, former Hanshin Tiger. For those of you who don't know, he joined the team in 2010 and stayed until the end of 2015. He collected 1,020 hits over his career with the Tigers. And in his first year, he broke the record for most hits in a single season in NPB with 214. That has since been broken. But anyways, you know, we can't talk enough about the impact that Matt Merton had on the team, the impact that he had on the fans, and, you know, just what a great team player he was. And so it's been cool. You know, Matt and I have been in and out of touch, you know, by email, just short stuff back and forth throughout this past season. And he said, yeah, I'll be on the podcast. And so we sat down and Skyped together. Actually, it was last Monday, so about a week ago. But let's give it a listen, and we'll talk about it in a little bit.
All right.
Who's in that chair? Who's tea talking to? Who's in that chair? Maybe veteran, maybe who? Who's in that chair? Who's in that chair? Who's in the chair?
Okay, so everybody, I am here on this very special episode with somebody that we are all familiar with, Mr. Matt Merton. It is great to have you on the show.
Trevor, thanks a lot for having me.
Hey, it's wonderful to hear your voice. How are you doing, man?
We're good. We actually just got finished up with our AAA season a few weeks ago, and settling back in at home and becoming dad, you know, getting the opportunity to drive the kids to school. I just got done dropping them off and being able to be around the house a little bit more, which has been nice.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Well, I'm sure the kids are glad to have dad back for the off season as they are every year, right?
Yeah, no, it's fun. I mean, they, you know, they obviously enjoy the baseball aspect and getting to travel around and see different places and watch dad play. But they're always excited when dad's home because that just means I'm around a lot more and get to be a part of their lives a little bit more than I can during the season, you know?
Sure. Well, how did your kids' attendance at the games compare, like now that you're back stateside as opposed to at Koshien?
Yeah, it's a little different. You know, when they first went out to the first spring training game at Sloan Park or whatever there in Cubs spring training, they looked at Steph and they go, "Mommy, this is boring." So it's just kind of funny. They got used to, you know, the atmosphere there in Japan and whatnot, and that's all they really knew.
Right.
And so the game, obviously, in regards to the fans' interaction was a little bit different coming back to the U.S., but over the summer, they really started to enjoy it. And the fact that, you know, in AAA baseball, there's those in-between innings. They have all the different things that they do to entertain the kids and stuff. My oldest, Micah, was able to be a PA announcer, a junior announcer at, for one inning there. And they got to do some, my Macy was able to run and do the bebop race and throw out some first pitches and stuff. So they had fun. They came in the clubhouse and got to know a few of the players and stuff, which they enjoyed. So that aspect of it, the family involvement, obviously back in the U.S. is a little bit more so than Japan, but the atmosphere right. of the game itself obviously changes a lot coming back here because you can't really match what you get there at Koshien Stadium.
Yeah, absolutely. So take us through your 2016 season because we've been able to follow you, you know, from a distance, but we don't get to see the day-to-day. So, like, what you know, tell us a little bit about the team you're with and what were some of the highs and lows of your season?
Yeah, for sure. You know, coming back to the U.S. this year, I thought that it was very fitting for me to go back to the Chicago Cubs organization. It's kind of where I got my start in professional baseball, in regards to Major League Baseball especially. Right. And not only that, but Theo Epstein being the general manager, he was the one who originally drafted me with the Red Sox. And so it just kind of felt like I came full circle, getting that opportunity to put it back out there. And ultimate goal was to make it back to the Major League level. And when I came back, unfortunately, that, you know, I came into camp, I felt great, as usually do. I had a good off season. There wasn't anything that really set me back, and I got into camp, and it was very unfortunate. But within about a week, I believe it was, of being there, I ended up having to have an appendectomy, which they say there's really unfortunately no control over that. You know, it could be the altitude or the dryness of being out in the desert or not, they're not 100% certain, but I tell you what, it wasn't Japan. And I came back, and it's funny because you get so used to being in Japan, you almost have to adjust to being back in the U.S. So anyway, yeah, I had that appendectomy that knocked me out for a few weeks, 2.5-3 weeks during the bulk of spring training, which kind of made it very difficult for me. I ended up with 9 at-bats, I think, during the big league camp. I got some at-bats on the backfield and whatnot, and then sure enough, I finally started getting going there, and the beginning of the season for AAA was coming up, and part of me rushing back from the appendectomy, I tried to get back as soon as I could so as to be able to you know, have an opportunity to try to make the team with the ABs I could get, and it just wasn't enough. So anyway, by rushing back, there was a few things with my feet and stuff that I hadn't really gotten underneath my legs, and I had a couple things creep up on me. One was my toe. So I started the year off on the DL because my toe had flared up because of some of the different things I was doing in regards to compensating within my body. Mm-hmm. It was just a year, just to sum it up, man, that was very good in so many ways. I kind of was able to prove to myself that I'm still capable, more than capable of hitting. And, you know, even facing the high velocity pitchers back in the States, that was never one of my issues. And coming back, I was still able to get in there and compete against those guys and have quality at bats. Even against some of the better pitching on backfields and stuff during spring training. So I felt really good about that. It was just unfortunate. It seemed like the timing of each of these injuries came at some of the worst times. And a lot of it was just kind of crazy freak things. Like I ended up having the toe set me back. I got going for a few weeks, and then I ended up having a strained oblique muscle. They say that could have had something to do with the appendectomy and the fact that you were in and out now. And so it was like the whole year I was in rebuild mode instead of being able to really thrive the way I wanted to, whether it be my at-bats or my physical body or whatever it was. So I had that, and then I got back playing again. I finally started to get going, and sure enough, I ran into the wall. I led with my knee as I ran into the wall. I was able to make the catch, which was nice. But I've hit the wall a million times over the course of my career, and this particular one, when I hit it with my knee, I found out that I thought I had a bone bruise at first, or a bone, like a bruise there. Uh-huh. I continued to play on it for about a week, and come to find out as it got worse, I had a strain of my quad muscle there. So that kind of put me out for basically the rest of the year. So it was just one of those years where I was on and off the DL. It was the first time in my career I'd ever been on the DL. Okay. I know that, you know, there was a few hammy things that flared up while I was in Japan, and I missed maybe the beginning portion of the 2012 season, but I was never officially on a DL, I don't think. So it was just one of those years, and some of the highs were just getting back out there and competing back in the U.S. and proving to myself that I'm still more than capable of doing it, and just being part of a clubhouse and having teammates and stuff that I could really try to pour into, you know, a lot of younger guys. I became the older guy of the clubhouse there at the AAA level, and so it was fun that way. Some of the lows were just the way the unfortunate things happened during the course of the year for my body just kind of made it tough. But so I go on and on about it, but the long and short of it was is that I know I was exactly where I was meant to be for that particular season, and it'll be interesting to see what God has for this upcoming year.
Absolutely. So did you feel like the odds were stacked against you right from the start because of how stacked the Cubs are?
You know, to some degree, but I never really worry about that. Because, see, for me, it's always along the lines of I need to take care of what I can take care of and control what I can control. And, again, it's in, as a believer, it's in God's hands. I mean, he's going to work through the circumstances no matter how favorable they look or how unfavorable they look. And as a competitor, I've always believed in my ability. And if I can get the most out of myself, then I really feel like the rest of that takes care of itself. I've been very fortunate over the course of my career to compete at a very high level no matter where I've been. And you have to continue to kind of rely on those things to put your nose down and go to work. There's a lot of good players in the game of baseball, but I'm aware of what abilities God has given me. And again, sometimes for me, some of the circumstances that look to be against the most odds are the ones that turn out to be the best. And some of the ones that look like they're sure bets end up being nothing. So I didn't go into it with that mindset. I kind of went out there just competing, enjoying the competition, enjoying being around the guys, and just kind of see where it was going to fall.
Right on. Well, so I think if I remember correctly, I don't know if it was your quote or somebody else, but I'm going to assume it was you that said at one point that NPB was maybe somewhere between AAA ball and MLB, you know, highest level, so like a quadruple A. Did you say something like that in an interview at one point?
Well, what I did say is that people were asking me to compare Japan back to AAA baseball. Uh-huh. And there's no doubt in my mind that Japan, Japanese, the NPB, is at a higher level than AAA baseball. There's no doubt in my mind. The idea between AAA and the NPB is, the bottom line is, the NPB, in my estimation, is definitely ahead. And not only that, but closing the gap on Major League Baseball. I mean, you see all these players coming over, again, Shunfan, Maiken, and these guys here recently, Darvish Tanaka, and we go through the whole list, and they succeed. Mm-hmm. There's some really good arms in Japan. And just baseball as a whole, the fundamentals of the game, and everything else has played at a very high level there. And again, I have a much greater respect for Japan after having played there for 6 years than I did prior to that 2010 season. So that was it. I was just kind of asked, hey, what do you think about Japanese baseball compared to here? And playing the AAA level, no doubt the MPB, in my estimation, is ahead of that. Again, there's some great arms in AAA, throwing hard, good stuff. They're just not as polished, you know.
Right.
You get a much more polished product over there in Japan.
Well, unless it's the 2016 Tigers, but we won't go there. So let's look back on your 6 seasons with the team. Do you have any specific fond memories that stick with you, like even as you look back on your career in Japan right now?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, there's many. We could sit here all day and talk about them. I think that probably for me, one of the pinnacles was no doubt the 2014 season. Mm-hmm. When we were there in the Tokyo Dome, we had come in there and won 3 consecutive games. And in that first inning, there's some guys on base. I was able to get the 3-run home run, and Fukudome ended up adding another one in Nishioka, and just the Soon Fan closed that game out just from start to finish, just the way the game went, was so much fun to be a part of. And then to see the fans, and just how excited they were. But I just remember there was an overwhelming feeling during that season as that year went, and especially there during that particular game and series, that was like, man, this is what it's all about. And for the Tigers to have, since the inception of the new Climax series, and the current way it's set up, I think that series that we ended up getting through there in Hiroshima at home was the first one that we had won. And then to be able to go into Tokyo to win that series against our arch rival on their field to take us to the Nippon Series was incredible. And then obviously it's unfortunate the way that series ended up going. But again, I felt like we were in most of those games. I think if I look back on it, other than 2 of the games, the game that we won and the game that they won pretty handedly, which I think was the 3rd game of the series, the first game there in Fukuoka, every game almost came down to the last at bat. I remember we had multiple chances in game 2 there with runners in scoring position. And I think I had one of them to be able to tie the game up late. And then you go into game 4, it was there in Fukuoka. They won on a walk-off home run, which mm-hmm. comes down to the last at bat. And then in game 5, the unfortunate way that whole thing ended. But we were right there in each of those games. So I think that series was one of those series that Fukuoka, you know, SoftBank has had a tremendous team for a long time, the last so many years, and they're very deserved of winning that series. But I really felt like we had a club that year that was capable of winning the series, and it just didn't go our way for that particular series. But again, that was to me probably one of the greatest highlights of my time, and one of the memories that I will take with me for a long time was just to be out on that field. On that 4th game, I guess it's the 5th game of the series, but the 4th game that we were actually playing, and to win that in Tokyo, to go to the Nippon Series, and just see the fan reaction was one of the coolest moments I had there in Japan.
Excellent. Well, right after that, you got to face your former teammate and good friend, Jason Standridge, in game 1 of the Nippon Series. How did that feel?
Well, it felt good. Like, the game's a competition, and no matter if it's your friend or not, you want to win. And, he was able to pitch earlier that year tremendously well. He had his cutter working at Koshien. Uh-huh. He shut us down. I don't know if he went 9 innings. I think he did. I think he 8 or 9 innings of shutout baseball, and he really had us. So to be able to come back and get him and during the Nippon Series was a nice feeling. He got us once, we got him once, but to be able to get it there in the Nippon Series was nice. He's had a tremendous career over there, great player. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was a lot of fun to be able to face him there in Koshien and get, you know, the game again. You know, each and every day, you never know how it's going to go. You throw it out there and see what happens. But to be able to come back and score some runs off of him in game 1 after he shut us out was a great feeling. To be honest, after we won that game there, I think at that point, throughout the playoffs, we had yet to lose a game. We were 1-0-1 in the first series. We were 4-0 there in the next series. So we were 5-0-1, and then to win that, we were 6-0-1. I thought I thought the Nippon series was ours at that point. We felt really good about our chances. We had a really good team, but like I said, it just didn't go our way. But that was a great series. It was a lot of fun, and being able to face Jace there in that first game at Koshien, and just the atmosphere of Koshien, for as good as the atmosphere is throughout the year, that Nippon series felt like another level. So that was just, it was a lot of fun to be able to play in that environment.
Nice. Well, speaking of facing former teammates, let's go back to the date, July 8th of 2005. Probably doesn't ring a bell necessarily to you, but you were with the Cubs and you were facing.
Oh, I know. Marlins. I remember.
You know. You yeah. Remember. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Of Tell course. Us about that then.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, you came in, I think, partway through the game. Is that right? Or did you? Yeah, you came in partway through the game, and then the reliever for the Marlins came in after the game was out of hand, and that was Randy Messenger. So you got to face him in MLB, and you were both, I think, in your first years. Is that right?
Yeah, no, that's correct. Yeah. So it was July 8th, 2005. It was actually 2 years to the exact date that I signed my major league contract, which was July the 8th of 2003. And not only was that 2 years to the exact date, but I was being called up to play in Florida, which is where I saw my first major league game as a kid, because I grew up in South Florida. Mm-hmm. There was friends and family there. I remember getting the call. I was in Knoxville, Tennessee, when I found out in AA. I got up. I didn't get a whole lot of sleep at all. I got up early that morning, flew in, and I was so excited to be there. And never in my wildest dreams did I expect to be in the lineup. But in actuality, I was. I started that game against Dontrell Willis, mm-hmm. Who at the time was one of the top left-handed pitchers in baseball. And I was very fortunate. I got a hit in my first at-bat. I ended up in that particular game. I think I was 2-for-2 with a walk, a sac fly. And one of that second hit was off Randy Messenger. He came in, and he was in his first year, the same that I was. Randy obviously has continued to grow as a pitcher and had a tremendous career. But at the time, he was very much a four-seam fastball guy down and away, which he still does. And at the time, he was throwing mid-90s, mid-upper 90s, so he really had a good arm. And I got one of those fastballs away, and I was able to do what I do and shoot it inside the first base bag there. At the time, Carlos Delgado was playing first, and he was playing off the line a little bit, so I shot it down the line on a fastball away and was able to get to second base on it. But yeah, those are memories that you'll never forget in the game, and it was a lot of fun. I remember getting to first base, and Carlos Delgado, on my first particular hit, he goes, "Nice hit, kid." Mm-hmm. He goes, "You got 2,999 more to go," and he started laughing. So anyway, after that second one, I had 2,998 more to go. I didn't quite get there, but I've been very fortunate and very fortunate to have had a good career thus far.
Impressive memory. Did you ever talk to Randy about that once you guys were with Hanshin together?
No, I kind of left it alone. It's just not my, it's not really my style, man. I love the game. I love having fun. But if Randy wasn't bringing it up, I sure wasn't going to bring it up to him. He may not even remember, but, anyway, yeah. So again, I got him that one time. We could face each other a million times over and you never know how it's going to go. But on that particular day, I got that fastball away and I found that hole. So it was good.
Nice. What would you say Randy's strengths are as a pitcher and as a teammate?
I think more than anything, he wants to compete. And, when he's on that mound, he's continued to grow. He's had that split finger. He's creating some depth to his pitches now that he maybe didn't have before. He was more of a flat four-seam slider, one plane guy. He had the other pitches, but those pitches have really developed as he's been over there. And more than anything, he takes the ball and he wants to go. He wants to go deep. And so he's a workhorse. He competes. And there's no doubt that when he's on the mound, your expectation is you can win that game. So, you know, that's the biggest thing. I mean, I think one of the best things you can say about a player is their competitive nature and how they go out there and give you a chance to win every time they take the ball.
Right. Now, you had a number of American or foreign teammates while you were with Hanshin. Are you still in touch with any of those guys?
Yeah, no, I try to. Yeah, I've been emailing or texting or line or whatever back and forth with the guys. Trying to stay in touch with Oki-san and some of the people there, as well as Mauro and Randy and stuff. And we don't talk on a regular basis, but I do check in with them throughout the year and just try to see where they're at and how they're doing. But like I said, it's not a lot, and it's not a lot really with anybody. I think too often we get caught in the pattern of wherever we are, we really focus on those people that we're with and around, and it's easy to lose touch. So I've tried to be more intentional about that, but no, I've definitely touched base with them again. Not a lot, and really no different than a lot of other guys that I've played with over the years.
Right. Now, as far as your Japanese teammates on the Tigers, who would you say was the most, I don't know, like the most enjoyable to share the field with, or like who is one of the Japanese guys that you got along with well?
One of my favorites, there was a lot of them. One of my favorites was definitely Tortani. And the reason it was is because we kind of, 2010, when I came over, we were both the same age, we're Dokusei. And from 2010, I believe, to the 2015 season, I believe Toritani and I were the only two regular starters remaining from that 2010 season that was still playing in 15. So just to have been there with him along each step along the way, his work ethic is tremendous. There's not a guy that can outwork him. I really appreciated that about him and how he went about his business. And that really was some of the, you know, things that really drew me to him. There's many other guys. Ryota was a lot of fun. He always had a good personality. Imanari-san, great personality off the field. We're able to have some good times. I enjoyed all of my teammates. Those guys kind of stick out to me the most. Obviously, when I first came up, it was Kanimoto-san and older Arai, and Jojima was a huge, I think Jojima was very instrumental in my success in Japan, because he had been in the U.S. He kind of knew what we did over here. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Jojima, and he really kind of took me under his wing and was always there to ask me how I was doing, and he really engaged me in a way that maybe not typical of the Japanese culture, and he was always looking out for me. And so Jojima was a huge help to me when I first came over to get me going. And there was many, many players that I felt that way about. But again, over the years, that kind of changed as some of the older guys started to leave. It became some of the younger guys. So again, Toritani was one of those guys I was with the whole time. That's kind of why he sticks out more than any of the others, I believe.
Okay. Now you said Dokusei just earlier, and so obviously you've still got some of your Japanese with you, but do you have any like kind of favorite Japanese expressions or any Japanese that has stuck with you even since leaving Japan?
Yeah, you know, some of my favorite is just the Kansai man, you know, and like bochi bochi de na and oki ni and maido and those type of things. But a lot of it I've really tried to continue to use. I had Kawasaki-san, Munenori Kawasaki was on my team this year.
Yeah.
So I was able to speak as much Japanese as I could with him, you know. And I've been intentional here in Nashville area, actually, trying to stay involved with the Japanese community that's here. Nissan's headquartered here. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of Japanese families, so we get together every so often. In fact, today, my thought is maybe at lunchtime I'm going to go over and join a few of them for lunch. And so I'm trying to continue to use as much Japanese as I can, so I keep it with me and don't completely forget it.
Now, is that with the intention of perhaps returning to Japan at some point, or you know, is it just something that you want to keep just as a skill set, or?
I think more than anything, Japan will always be a part of who we are. And for my wife, Stephanie, and I, and our kids, that's never going to change. Now, our intention is to always stay connected to some degree to that community. And we don't know exactly what that looks like, you know, whether that means that I end up coming back over there and playing at some point, whether that means that I end up coming back over there for different opportunities that may arise, or just trying to engage and love on the Japanese community here in the U.S., whatever it may be, Japan will always be a part of who we are, and that's something that we're not soon going to forget. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see. It's again, like I said, it's something that I have to remain intentional about, and something that we foresee being a part of, whether it's here or over there, for the foreseeable future. So we just want to try to remain as connected as we can.
Well, and I think too, like you were saying earlier, that you know, as a believer and believing that God uses all situations and all circumstances and even all skills, that, you know, surely you're hanging on to the Japanese and maintaining it is for a reason. And you may not know when it's going to, you know, come to fruition, but there's probably something there beyond, you know, what you can see.
Yeah, no, 100%. That's the thing. It's like, I don't know what that looks like, you know? I mean, only God knows that. And so in time, I think that that will become more obvious to us again. And if for anything else, it's just to be able to love and engage the Japanese community here. Because we, having lived in Japan for 6 years, know what it's like to be a foreigner in another country. Mm-hmm. And as great as the United States is and as great as Japan is, you're still outside of your comfort zone in a lot of ways. And so just to know where they're coming from and to be able to engage them in that way, I think is very important to us.
Good. So what do you miss about Japan, having now been away for a whole year? What are some things that you kind of wish that you could still have at your fingertips, or places that you wish you could go, or things like that?
Yeah, the shoyu ramen I miss a little bit. Actually, it became the miksu at the end there. I did the shoyu and miso, miksu. Uh-huh. But no, the ramen, obviously, you can't really get that here. I found a little ramen shop downtown Nashville I might need to try out, but I doubt that it's going to be what Japan is. So the food, you know, we miss the food. I got to develop a relationship with a guy here, Nobu-san, who owns a restaurant here in Nashville. He's actually from Osaka. He's been in the U.S. for about eight years. Tremendous chef. Does sushi. He actually makes some gyudon for me every once in a while. So it's been a really cool relationship to develop with him. And so whenever I'm having the need to have something Japanese in regards to food, he does a really good job of putting that together. So that's been nice. But the food is probably what we miss the most. Not the most. It's one of the things we miss the most. The people, more than anything, obviously, is what
we
miss. Obviously, the people is what you miss. I mean, the relationships that you were able to develop while you were there and stuff, and just being able to stay. I just wish the two countries were a lot closer together. But the people, obviously, the food, the culture, like I said. But again, I still feel like it's part of who we are. We, in our home now, I still have my Yoshinoya bowls out. We still have our pepper shakers and stuff that we got while we were over there, our spices, you know, choto karai desu ne. And we still use those kind of things in our home. You know, we're out to eat, the kids, we find the payways in different restaurants here so that our kids can eat the rice. So our kids are even, especially the younger ones, are even, privy to the food and stuff. And I remember our youngest, he actually went to Nobu-san's restaurant and he gets his rice from outside of the country. He gets it from Japan and or in California where they ship it in. And most of the rice in the U.S. is not as good. It's just not as good as the rice in Japan. And it's so funny because at first when I got to Japan, I couldn't tell the difference between good rice and not so good rice. But after being there for 6 years, I started to figure that out a little bit. Yeah, and so when we came to Nobu-san's place and ate the rice there, I was like, man, this is good rice. And sure enough, we brought our kids back the next time. And Daniel, he's 2 years old. He eats the rice and he goes, mama, this good rice. So even our kids, you know, I think the food, the people, the culture, just being able to do those kind of things are definitely the things that you miss.
Right. Okay. So tell us, what does the near future look like for Matt Merton? Like, are you still with the Cubs for next season, or are you a free agent again, or what's the situation looking like for you?
Yeah, no, I will end up becoming a free agent. You know, obviously, my agent has already spoken to the club just to kind of get a feel for where I'm at in regards to my playing career at 35 here in October. They were very positive in that conversation. It's one of those things where as you get older, it just becomes a matter of fit. You know, I definitely know that I'm still capable of playing the game. And so at this point, we're going to continue pursue the game until the Lord tells us differently. So as of now, the 2017 season, I'm expecting to play. But again, that can change very easily. But right now I'm preparing my body, my mind. Stephanie and the kids are on board, and we're going to continue to pursue it until we feel like that door is closed.
Well, man, I wish you all the best in 2017, and I hope your body cooperates a little bit better than it did this past season, and it should be a good year for you, I hope.
Cool, man. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, man. I just go out there and enjoy the game I can for as long as I can. And then when it's time to be done, look forward to that next opportunity.
Awesome. One more thing before we leave. Actually, this episode of the podcast will be coming out on October the 3rd, which would be your birthday, if I'm not mistaken. So happy birthday to you, the big 3-5.
With Tashi Tanjobi, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Nathan Tanjobi. It's also my son's birthday.
Okay, yeah.
So it's easy for me to remember, but... yeah, good stuff. So
very
this
nice.
Will be this
That's
will be
awesome.
Your this will be your first possibly anyways your first birthday in America since maybe 2009 or something like that, right?
Yeah, it's been a while. It's been a while. I think the only other year I was actually here was possibly 2012, and that's a year that I just prefer not to quite think about. It was a tough season for me, for the team.
Yeah.
You know, we had a good run there, man. I think 4 out of the 6 years we were in the playoffs. But the 2012 year was not particularly one of the best, but that's life. That's baseball. But yeah, so I'll enjoy being at home, being able to be with the family here in the U.S. But, for the reason that I know it's where I'm supposed to be right now. If next year we end up over in Japan and I am playing baseball and not home for the third, that'll be okay too. Or if I'm playing Major League Baseball and I'm not able to be home, that'll be fine too. So we'll just take it as it comes. But right now I am enjoying being home with the kiddos and the family.
Excellent. Well, Matt, thank you very much for taking the time with us today. We appreciate it so much and wish you all the best. Have a great happy birthday, a good off season, and we'll be rooting for you in 2017 as we have all this past year as well.
Thanks a lot, Trevor. I appreciate it. And thanks to all the Tigers fans for all the support over the years. And not only throughout the years, but the reception that I got even this year, just people sending things and communicating back and forth. It means a lot to me. Again, that time period, those 6 years will never be forgotten. And the people and the team and everything was an awesome experience. So not only a thank you to you, Trevor, but also to all the Tigers fans who have been supportive over all these years. Thank you so much.
Everyone that's listening will get it direct, and the rest I'll pass it on in some way or form. Cool. But yeah, thanks again.
Cool.
All right.
Thanks a lot, man.
So, what'd you think, Joe?
I think it was a really, really good interview. Definitely a lot of insight into his season that I think a lot of us didn't get to see. So, yeah, the first thing, you know, my first comment is, wow, it sounds like a hell of a tough season to be, you know, such a healthy player in his previous how many years, and mm-hmm. then to roll into this year and be, you know, can't win, you know, any which way health-wise, so.
And it seems like a lot of it wasn't carelessness on his part by any means. I mean, obviously the appendix is, you know, cannot be predicted or prevented. And then other stuff beyond that just, you know, just seems like it was poor luck or just poor timing or whatever, you know. So, and right. You know, this was the season that I think at age 34, you know, heading into the season, he was looking to make that impact and say, hey, I can still hang with, you know, the best of, certainly the best of the minors, but even in the majors. I mean, you know, he was hoping mm-hmm. to get called up, and you know, maybe if his health had been there, he would have, but we can't play the what if game here. I'm glad to hear though that he finished his AAA season. I don't think he said this, but he batted around 310, 315 throughout the year in AAA. So that's pretty solid.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Anything else catch your you know,
yeah, no, that interview? The one thing that really caught my ear as well was the talk about how the Japanese culture is now a part of him and his family. And I can absolutely mm-hmm. relate to that, as, you know, even only living over there for 1 year, I still, you know, enjoy the, you know, the Japanese meals and things like that. So when he talks about, you know, going to get good meals and all that, I can relate. So every time I make it up to New York City, I make an effort to get to the Mitsuo, which is the big Japanese grocery store there, and have lunch, or at least, you know, have some good food there and pick up some snacks and those kind of things. So it really is, you know, kind of a part of me now, and I can absolutely relate to that with Matt. And I thought it was kind of funny when he talked about his kids, you know, coming back this year and watching one of his games and be like, this is boring, because absolutely American baseball is so much more boring than Japanese baseball to watch. So
yeah, you know, it is really cool that his family had such a great time here in Japan, and you know, obviously they are back, quote unquote, home. But it may take his kids a lot longer to make that home, truly make it home, than it does for he and his wife.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The other thing that kind of caught me off guard or surprised me, and maybe it's just because I've been on a bit of a Torii bashing roll, is that he said that the player that he enjoyed playing with most among the Japanese players was Torii Tani.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I mean, you know, his reasons are obviously, you know, pretty good reasons. They, you know, they're the only two guys in 2015 that were still on the, you know, starters, you know, from 2010 right through 2015. So his whole time, and then the work ethic thing. And we know that Matt Merton's a hard worker as well. So, you know, just seeing those common traits, and then they're the same age. So that was kind of cool as well.
Yeah. Definitely a really cool interview, and hope that he, can find a spot for next year. It was kind of interesting. He also said that he's willing to come back to Japan if the opportunity presents itself. So I don't know if that'll be with Tigers, but you know, I'd like to see him back. But
sure, yeah, you know, I get the feeling that he probably won't be back here as a player, but I wouldn't be surprised to see him back here as a coach or doing something with the team at some point, because, you know, having no experience or no real connection with other teams out there, I think it's either Tigers or nothing as far as coaching goes. You know, another team may pick him up as a player, but even then, I think a lot of teams are going to say, look, he's 35 years old, he's at the end of his career. But I don't know. I mean, I wish him all the best either way, like I said in the interview. And you know, I've been a big fan of his. I'm privileged to be able to say I'm now a friend of his. So yeah, it was great to have him in that interview. And you know, if the opportunity presents itself again, either early next season or some point down the road, I'd love to interview him again, catch up with him once again. And I'm sure Tigers fans always want to know how Matt Mertin is doing. So
absolutely,
that'd be great. Yeah. All right, Joe. Well, we do have three games that we played last week that we can certainly recap, as we've been doing all season long. So let's jump into the action here. Our three games were Tuesday and then Friday and then Saturday. So Tuesday, we were hosting the Yakult Swallows at Koshien Stadium. And our starter on the day was the Blue Goat, Aoyagi. I think I had said that it would probably be Fujinami, because I was thinking it would be Fujinami and then Messenger Iwasada on the weekend. Anyways, it was the Blue Goat, Aoyagi, and he went up against Yamanaka. So it was kind of cool. It was like the guy that has the quarter throw versus the guy that has the submarine throw. And so, you know, two definitely unconventional pitchers on the mound. And Yamanaka is one that we haven't had success against most of the year. We figured him out last time. So go ahead, Joe, take us through the start of the scoring here.
All right. So starting off in the first with a Takayama triple, Hojo comes up at a 2-1 count and gets a double to left to score the first run of the game.
Sorry, that was an Itayama triple, yeah?
Itayama. Okay, sorry.
Yes. Yeah. No worries. No, it's the other Yama. And the guy that in his hero interview back in the day said, hey, Takayama's not the only rookie on this team, so pay attention to me. And then you just ignored him. That's okay. So no worries. So 1-0. I really thought, you know, when you got a runner on second and no outs, which was the case after the Hojo RBI, I was hoping for another run there, but no such luck.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And actually, the Swallows came back in the top of the third, and this started with the Aoyagi special. A walk, followed by a bunt, and then eventually an RBI single to left field. It got past Toritani, and that was that 1-1 ball game. And they went clean a good chunk of the rest of the way until the seventh inning. And partway through the seventh, the Goat got pulled because, after recording one out, it was him, wasn't it? There was a single and then a ground out, and then there was supposed to be a sacrifice bunt from their pitcher, and the Goat, I think, threw it away. So that put runners on first and second, and then I think we brought Iwasaki in, mm-hmm. That's right. And then we had another beautiful error. This one was by none other than...
Toritani.
The Bird Valley Toritani, yes. And what an error this one was, man. I mean, I think 8-year-olds could have made this play. A dribbler to third that went through Toritani's legs. I mean, it was the softest grounder that you could possibly misplay. so anyways, that extended the inning, that allowed the run to score. I think they scored on that error.
Right.
Yeah, so really embarrassing for Toritani. It is now the lead is now in the Swallows' hands, but in the bottom of the seventh, Joe.
In the bottom of the second, Takayama comes up with runners on first and second and gets a hit to center to score another run, tying it up 2-2. So yes, that was Takayama this time, not Itayama.
This was Taka. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so it's looking good, except that the Swallows take the lead back again the very next inning. Top of the eighth, runner on second, and this guy named Nishida hits a double to center. This one was with Satterwhite on the mound, and it looked bad, but we had a drawn-in outfield. So it actually could have possibly been caught had we been playing our outfield at regular depth. But anyways, they take the lead, and now it's looking really bad because the game is, you know, getting into the later phases and we're down, later stages.
Right. But Gomez is up first in the bottom of the eighth and strikes out, so we're not doing so well. Then Toritani comes up, gets a hit, followed up by a Haraguchi pinch hit. And then Araki comes up with runners on first and second, one out, and gets a double to score the first run, making it 3-3, tying it up. And yes. Then next comes Umeno, who's known for his bat. Maybe not. Runners on second and third, and actually gets the winning hit to center to score the first, the leading run there, making it 4-3.
The leading run, which ends up being the winning run, right. Because we bring in Mateo and gets him 1-2-3, and actually strikes out Yamada Tetsuto to end the game. Strikes him out swinging and does his awesome game-ending pose. So the Tigers' win streak now is extended to 5 meaningless games. But funny how...
Game, though.
Yeah, it was. It was an exciting one. And, you know, we got 12 hits on the day, and we committed 3 errors, so it was, you know, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times. But, yeah, overall, I think we played a good game. We got, you know, I think 4 doubles... 5 doubles and a triple. So a lot of extra base hits as well. It's just really nice to see. It's a nice change for our guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let us move on then to Friday's game. And Friday's game, we bring Mr. Fujinami to the mound. And we are going up against... Oh, man. You know what? They didn't even bring their best pitchers because they used them earlier in the week. And so we went up against Utsumi. Utsumi does have really good record against us, but that's not saying a lot because a lot of mediocre pitchers do. Anyways, this one, man, I don't know if we just start with the scoring plays. We go all the way to the eighth inning because our boy Fujinami, oh my goodness, he allowed a single in the first inning and walked a guy in the second inning, and that's it. So good Fujinami came out to play in this one. Meantime, we got a couple of hits. We had some chances, particularly the second inning against Utsumi, but nothing doing. So if we go all the way to the eighth, Fujinami actually only went 6 innings and struck out 7, only threw 82 pitches. So half of his total from the punishment game from a couple months ago. But we brought in Nomi in relief. Again, and he pitched a clean inning. Ando pitched a third of an inning, only faced one batter. And then Iwazaki was the one that actually allowed the damage to be done with a single, a sacrifice bunt, and then an RBI double from Chono. It went over the center fielder's head and hit the wall, and it was an easy run scored right there. So 1-0, it's looking pretty bad because actually we didn't get anything in the bottom of the eighth. And they didn't get anything in the top of the ninth. So bottom of the ninth, we're facing Sawamura, who we don't have great success against. Take it away, Joe.
All right. So first up is Gomez and grounds out to third. So second game in a row, he's come up first in the ninth and come up with nothing. Mm. But let me continue on here. Takayama comes up and gets a hit to the pitcher, kind of bounces off his leg, I believe, and gets the infield hit. Followed up by Haraguchi, who gets a hit to left to bring runners on to first and third. And Fukudome comes around and gets the hit to left to score the tying run. It is 1-1 and still one out. Next comes Toritani with a hit to right, but it was just a shallow hit to right, not enough to bring the run around.
Yeah.
So now bases are loaded, and guess who comes up to bat? But
T-Ray's Shunsuke. Favorite? Yeah, Shunsuke, yeah.
I was laughing when he came up to bat.
I was cringing.
I knew you'd be excited about that. So, one out, base is loaded, and all we need is a sack fly. And guess what? Shunsuke can't get a hit, but he gets the sack fly to win the game. The sayonara sack fly. And it was pretty close, though.
Yes, it was.
The throw was pretty close. So
yeah, it was Haraguchi on third, so, you know, not our best legs there. I'm surprised they didn't have a pinch runner come in for him. Although I don't know who we had left to bring in at that point.
That's true.
So,
because our pinch legs are at the bat.
Well, but Yamato did not play at all in this one, so I guess they could have brought him in. But anyways, that's besides the point. Haraguchi made it in safe. There are some beautiful pictures online of you know, from different angles of the play, of the celebration, all that stuff. It was great to see. And Shunsuke was the hero, hero interview. Man, did he ever look awkward. He did not know how to answer any of the questions with any excitement or with more than a few words. I mean, he just kind of looked dumbfounded.
Yeah, he reminded me of some of the sumo wrestler interviews. So just kept saying, you know,
pretty much. So anyhow, one interesting thing of note, other than the fact that we finally got to Sawamura, that was his 8th blown save, by the way, where he actually cost his team the game, I believe. Anyhow, what I was going to say is that in the 7th inning, there was a rain delay. I don't know if you caught the whole game or anything like that, but Toritani still hadn't played, and there was a rain delay, and we were thinking there's a possibility that the game gets called, and Toritani does not make an appearance, and so his Iron Man streak ends. No! But, you know, after about...
How lucky could we be?
Pardon me?
How lucky could we be? I mean, it's kind of how the Kanemoto one ended.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that one actually ended thanks to Shunsuke, so, yeah. For those of you that don't know, I think Kanemoto was up at the dish, right? Pinch hitting.
Yeah.
And Shunsuke tried to steal second, was caught stealing, and that ended the inning, which also ended Kanemoto's day because they didn't get around to a bottom of the 9th, I think. Is that right? And so he didn't ever get to the plate. So he didn't get, even though he stood at the dish and even took a pitch, it doesn't count as appearing in the game because the at-bat did not register. Anyways, so Toritani still has a chance to match that at some point, and it would be kind of cool if he did. So winning streak is 6, and Fujinami doesn't get the win. Actually, Kaneda gets the win in this one. Mm-hmm. So Fujinami ends the year 7 wins, 11 losses, 3.25 ERA. Not too bad if you look just at the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyhow, the season finale, and this would be the retirement game for Shinobu Fukuhara. There was talk of bringing Mochizuki in as the starter, but because fourth place was on the line, we decided we needed to put in a pitcher that we knew, I guess. And so Iwasada started this one. Go ahead, Joe.
All right. So starting off in the first, Haraguchi comes up with a runner on first and 2 outs and hits one to the fence, but gets stuck in the fence.
That was really interesting, man. That was
amazing. Got stuck between the pads, I guess, kind of. And so Hojo came in to score on the play, but they put him back on third due to the ball getting stuck. So then Gomez comes up after that with the runners on second, third, and 2 outs and gets the bases clearing double or hit to center to score the 2 runs, making it 2-0. For the start of the game. And then continuing on in the second inning, Hojo comes up with runners on second and third and 1 out and gets a center sack fly to score another run, making it 3-0 Tigers.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go a couple innings without any activity. Again, Giants still being held without runs on the board.
What do you mean no activity? Shunsuke got a hit. Come on.
Oh, boy. Yeah,
that's activity. Okay. That's newsworthy.
Only thing in the middle of the game.
Yes.
So then in the 7th, Uemoto comes up with runners on second and third, no outs, and gets a double to center to score those 2 runs, making it 5-0. And then continuing on in the 8th, Fukudome comes up with runners on first and third, no outs, and gets a sack fly to center to score the 6th run of the game for Tigers, 6-0. And guess what? That's the end of it. 6-0 Tigers.
Yes. So an amazing end to the season, shutting out the Giants. And we end the season on a 7-game win streak, which matches our longest losing streak of the year, which was also 7 games, which happened at the start of this month or the start of September. So good stuff. Good stuff.
Yeah. So Fukuhara came in to start the 8th inning, and he got 1 out, and then got pulled, which is a little strange to me. I know that, but you're up, what, 5 runs at that point?
I think still 3, right? Because
Uemoto
scored them in the...
He pitched in the 8th, so we were up 5 to...
Right. Okay.
We're up 5-0. And so it's his retirement game. He comes in, gets a fly out to center, I believe, and you know, only had, how many pitches there?
3
pitches. And then they come in and pull him. Come on. I'd say give him the inning. If he gets guys on, then you can pull him. But they need 5 runs.
Yeah. I think part of it might have been the emotional side of things. Of,
that's true.
Kanemoto handed him the ball, and then he handed it off to Ando, who is also his good buddy, and, you know, they're about the same age, and so I think maybe they wanted that little bit of drama in there as well. And you know, what would be worse than to keep him in the game and have somebody hit a home run off of him and have to pull him because he's right. in the jam? So, I do agree with you. It would have been nice. I think all the fans would have liked to have seen him strike somebody out and pull mm-hmm. him after the strikeout. I mean, that would be perfect timing, but you can't predict these things. You can't, you know what I mean? You can't rig them unless, I don't know. I guess there might be some rigging in baseball. Who knows? But we can't assume that they would do that for a retiring guy. So, yeah, that was that. And then also in the top of the ninth, we ended our season with a pitcher that I would not have picked to end the season with. And it wasn't Kyuji. So it was actually Atsushi Mochizuki, who was our fourth-round pick in last year's draft, straight out of high school. So he's 19 years old. It was his first and only appearance of the year. So he got one inning all year, and it was the last one of the season. And he did well, right. allowed one hit, but he struck out a guy as well, and he actually hit 153 kilometers per hour, which is
94.
I'm at here 94 miles.
Wait,
an hour.
No, 96.
Yeah, that's right, so. 96. So pretty impressive for a 19-year-old for a guy at high school. I mean, he could definitely bring a little bit more in the years to come.
Absolutely.
So certainly, you know, to end the year with him adds that little bit of extra excitement. Like, maybe Mochizuki can be part of the club for more than just one inning next year, like maybe half the season or all the season or whatever. And we've got another young arm, you know, another flamethrower that can help out our team, you know, on the pitching side of things. So, yeah, cool stuff.
So we end the season in fourth place, though.
Yes. So. And that actually happened thanks to Hiroki Kuroda and the Hiroshima Carp, who beat the Swallows a little bit later that day. If the Swallows had won, we would have been tied for fourth, but their percentage would have been 1/1000th higher than ours. So we would have been fifth, but we get fourth. So I don't know, a bit of a disadvantage in the draft, but maybe a little bit of pride that we can say that we were just one place out of the playoffs. We also finished closer to the playoffs than we did to last place. So that's another thing that we can, you know, take with us. Because there isn't a lot to take with us, you know, truth be told. So, this is it, Joe. This is our final chance to do Player of the Week.
Every week, one tiger stands above the rest. He elevates his game to another level. He is the Player of the Week.
And this would be for the week of just three games. And,
right.
Yeah. Who we got?
Definitely a lot of offense this week, so.
Yeah.
Made it pretty tough. Let's see, how many players had it? Do a quick count here. We have 8 players on the team for this week that actually had greater than 400 batting average.
Ooh, wow.
It's pretty impressive because not a lot of players played a lot of games, but, you know, definitely a good week for the batting effort. So I am going with somebody that had, let's see, he went 5 for 12, had 2 RBIs. So I am giving it to Hojo this week, batting 417.
Nice. Yep. As a matter of fact, this is only Hojo's second time making it as Player of the Week because he got it, in the middle of August. Although on the whole, he had a good season. Absolutely. I am going to give it to a pitcher, to Shintaro Fujinami, because this is the second straight week that he actually pitched very well. And he didn't go as deep as he did last time, but 6 innings of clean ball, 1 hit, 1 walk, 7 strikeouts, only 82 pitches. To me, that's a little, you know, flicker, a little flame of hope for next year that maybe with the right mix of rest and practice in the offseason, he can be the ace that we expect him to be. So I'm going Fujinami. Part of that is emotional, right. But yeah. So there you have it. The final Player of the Week. Now, it's September, or the end of September, and we'll include this one game in October. But we want to choose a pitcher, or pardon me, a hitter and a pitcher of the month.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to run through some candidates, Joe, you may. And let's go with hitter first.
Okay.
Yeah.
Definitely, you know, decent month for hitting again. Not your normal candidates towards the top. Uemoto had a good month. He was 11 for 33, so batting 333. Let's see. Araki was also 333. Hojo, 299. Fukudome, 294. And Takayama, 270. But my top two candidates are Takayama and Hojo because of the they each had three home runs and a good deal of RBIs. But I am going to go with Hojo batting 299 with seven RBIs and three home runs and a stolen base.
You don't want to go with Toritani batting 210? Okay.
No.
Enough Toritani bashing. Yeah, okay, Hojo definitely worthy. And I love the way that he ended the season really strong. I mean, honestly, from I would say, June onwards. Mm-hmm. Oh, even May, he was pretty good, although he didn't get a ton of playing time. But, right. You know, he really, once he started to get regular playing time, he was hitting the ball well, hitting it with a bit more authority, sticking in there a little bit more as far as not striking out as easy as he did at the start of the year. So good stuff for him for sure. I'm going to actually choose the other guy, Takayama. He had, all right, I think, 12 RBI, and he just excited me. He excited a lot of mm-hmm. fans, so... Yeah.
Sounds good.
There we are. And for me, for pitcher of the month, I'll go straight into it. I really don't think there's another candidate other than this guy, especially if you include his October 1st outing. You know, his ERA for the month, I don't have it in front of me, but I think it was around 0.5 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a good possibility that he gets pitcher of the month in the Central League. So if we don't choose him for the Tigers, it's saying something's wrong with our eyes or our selection choice. But he including October the 1st, he got 5 wins in 5 starts. And yeah, for September, mm-hmm. his ERA was 0.58, and then October, his one outing was 0. So Yuta Iwasada.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Not a question.
He also gave
a runner-up to Mateo with 5 saves and a 0.0 ERA on the month. So,
yeah, and Mateo, like, I think I plugged him last month with Player of the Month. And so he ends the season, I think it's with 31 and a third innings and 1 earned run.
20 saves.
20 saves on the year, yeah. So he definitely turned things around. And I really think that our pitching became our strength at the end of the year.
Absolutely.
And I had somewhere like a list of where we ranked in all the major categories, but I don't have it in front of me right now. I can try and pull up at least some of it. Runs scored, we finished 5th with 506. Chunichi with 500 below us. Runs against, we finished 3rd fewest, which is pretty good. And we'll look at ERA right after that. We actually finished 2nd in ERA. And the reason that we were better in ERA than we were in runs allowed is because of we finished last in errors, far and away. Last meaning most, not fewest. And then as far as batting average goes, we finished tied for last.
Tied for last, yeah.
Yeah, tied with Chunichi for last place. Home runs, we finished 1 ahead of Chunichi, so we got 5th place. And stolen bases, we finished 1 below Chunichi. With 59, so that's last place in stolen bases. So pretty
bad.
Yeah, we
had exactly half of what the Carp did.
That's exactly right, yeah. And our leader was Toritani and our 2nd place guys. I made a mistake last week. I think I said last time we talked about this, I think I said Nishioka had 7, but he had 6. He and Hojo tied for 2nd on the team with 6. Yeah, pretty rough year. So I definitely hope that the call-up of Kai Ueda at the end of the year, and he tried a stolen base in the final game of the year and
didn't
failed.
Work.
Yeah. He was pretty close. He got a bad jump, though. But
Hopefully
he can do a better job next year if he gets the playing time. So we definitely need a guy. Like, I mean, our pinch runners, sorry, Shunsuke doesn't steal bases. Yamato doesn't steal bases. You know, if we're going to bring in a pinch runner, I really hope it's somebody that's a threat on the base path and not just someone that runs well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So that is part of the year in recap. Now, let us actually get into today's special topic, which is the H10 Awards. So, this was a rather interesting year, if I may so say so myself, and we kind of alluded to it in the show opener. But I've got a list of different awards that I want to go through with you, Joe, and talk about for the year 2016. So we have a list of different categories that we want to go through with you. And, you know, if you want to, as you're listening, just kind of chime in. We won't hear your voice, but you can chime in with your choices. Or if you want to send us your choices, that's great too. So the first one that I want to talk about is Hitter of the Year. It's kind of an obvious one to start with. And there were different guys that could be argued for here. I mean, we got Gomez, who led the team in home runs, RBIs, and runs scored. 22 home runs, 79 RBIs, and 56-ish runs scored. So pretty solid. But I'm not going with him. Who you got, Joe?
I am going with Kosuke Fukudome. So even at the age of 39, he still led the team in batting average, on base, slugging, and was fifth in the Central League for batting average. So definitely kind of a surprise to me that he can still hold on with such a good bat in his hand. So definitely I think his bat saved us a number of times, you know, during the season, and was always a reliable bat on the team almost all year. So I'm going to give it to Fukudome.
Absolutely. Batting .311 with this year just 11 home runs. I think last year he had 20. So a bit of a drop there, and just 59 RBIs. But part of that is situational. And his on-base percentage was .392. His OPS was .845, which easily led the team and is a very respectable number, whether you're 39 or not. Definitely worthy there. I'm going to go elsewhere, and I'm going to say Shun Takayama, number 9. And his batting average was not as high, and some of his numbers were not quite as good as Fukudome's. But for a rookie, an outstanding year. He batted .275. With 8 home runs and 65 RBIs. So he actually exceeded Fukudome there. He finished second on the team in RBIs for a rookie. That's pretty amazing. He set the club record for most hits by a rookie with 136. He also scored 48 runs. He stole 5 bases. He hit 5 triples. And he was second in the Central League for batting average with runners in scoring position, which is very crucial, obviously, you know, when you want to score runs. That's when you got to get your hits. And I think he was .381 with runners in scoring position, second in all Central.
That's awesome.
And he stuck in the starting lineup almost the entire year. He had a bit of a period where he slumped and was pulled out. But other than that, you know, for a rookie to play that much and play that well, I'm willing to overlook his fielding. And especially because this is Hitter of the Year, not Fielder of the Year. Yeah. So Takayama gets it for me.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Fukudome, though, he only had one error the entire season, so that's pretty impressive at 39.
And Fukudome had some incredible, you know, diving catches in the field. He's just such a sound fielder, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Love him for sure. All right, so starting pitcher of the year. And, you know, we named our pitchers of the month every month through the year, and we don't necessarily have to go with who we chose there. But I don't know. I mean, it is a bit of a tough choice, you know. Fujinami had such great stamina with 161 pitches, 145 pitches, 138 pitches. I mean, you know, when a kid is that good at throwing the ball, oh, wait a minute, you know, he also led the Central League in walks. So I'll take him off the list. No, seriously, though, it was a little bit of, it was close. You know, if you take away June and July, it's hands down, it's Iwasada, because he actually finished with the top ERA on the team. But I'm going to go with Randy Messenger. Despite that.
Yeah, and I'm going to go with Randy as well. I mean, Iwasada had a great year, no doubt about it. But when he was struggling, he was struggling. And Randy always seemed to me like, you know, he's one of those pitchers where, you know, if you don't get a win when he goes up, you know, you're going to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was just, you know, definitely a solid player for the team again this year.
So he was tops in the Central in innings pitched. He was second in strikeouts, I believe, although Fujinami might have passed him. He was third in wins. He was number 6 in ERA in the league. And from start to finish, like you said, I mean, he was a reliable pitcher. He was the starting pitcher on opening day, which he has now done 3 times. And apparently he left the country today, I think. I saw it in the papers. And as he was leaving, of course, the reporters always, you know, they'll always ask questions. And one of the questions they always ask him is, do you think you're going to be the starting pitcher next year? And he said, hey, look at the numbers, man. I mean, I deserve it. It's kind of what he said. He may not have said exactly like that. But
we don't have a contract yet, do we?
I don't think so, but I think both sides know that it will end with the contract. I mean, I don't think Randy is going to highball them and say, you know, unless you pay me this much, I'm not coming. And I don't think the club's going to lowball him either. I mean, especially after the year that he had. So I think it's pretty much a given that he will be back.
Then the year after that, he's not a foreigner. So I could obviously see a 2-year deal being signed.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love that. I would welcome that for sure. So, yeah, excellent stuff for Randy. Our next award is going to be Reliever of the Year. And I'm going to give this one to Marcos Mateo. In spite of having a bad May, he had a 6.75 ERA in May. Outside of that, he was stellar. He was under 2 in every single other month. And that includes April, where people were starting to gripe about him. He was still under 2 that month. And when he came back in June, from that point on, he was outstanding. The only closer with better numbers, and I'm just looking at ERA, in the Central was Nakazaki for the Carp. And I don't even think Nakazaki's that good. The other thing is, Mateo will get you the strikeouts. He's pretty solid there. He seems unflappable. I mean, you know, even when guys were on base, he never really looked nervous or anything like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think I have to agree with you there. Mateo definitely deserves it. You know, Satterwhite came in mid-season. I think he had a little bit of a struggle, you know, kind of every time he went out, there was something on base or giving up some sort of run. So, he, you know, he's calmed down and had a better finish to the season. But, I mean, I think, you know, Mateo gets it hands down for me.
Yeah, the only other guy that might be worthy, except that he didn't play nearly the full season, would be Nyoma Matsuda, who came in and had a really good stretch there. I think his final line was that he went 27 innings overall and allowed just 3 earned runs. So that's an ERA of 1, which is a better ERA than Mateo. But, you know, like I said, he didn't play the full season. He also did not close games. So a little bit, you know, kind of lower leverage situations. But still, good job. Good job for him for sure. All right. Well, the next award that we are going to look at is the Farm Boy of the Year. So this was a season in which Kanemoto, you know, he brought a lot of guys up from the farm. He sent a lot of guys down to the farm. So a lot of guys got a lot of time on the farm. And if you look just purely at the raw numbers, and if you look especially at average, I think Haig had the best average of anybody in the farm. And he actually played quite a few games down there. But I'm not giving it to Haig, unfortunately. But who do you think had a good year on the farm that deserves some recognition for it?
I'm going to pick a player that never made it up to the team, actually. So
Saka?
I'm going to give it to Perez.
Okay.
He had a .313 batting average, 10 home runs, a .528 slugging, and a .398 on base. So, he definitely was, you know, towards the top 2 or 3 in all batting categories, and definitely was, you know, an asset to the farm team, but, just didn't happen to make it up on the top team. I don't know if that's because of, you know, foreign player count, and obviously is with the season that everybody else had coming up to the top team, you would have think he would have gotten the chance, but just didn't work out.
I think maybe he just wasn't in the big picture for what the team wants to do in the future. And I've heard that he's already left the country, and not a big surprise there. And I also heard, I haven't read this in print, but I've heard that he's not going to be back with the team next year. Anything could happen, though. You never know.
Yeah.
The other thing, interesting thing about Perez is that he only played in 69 games on the farm, which is not a huge number. As far as ranking goes, that puts him tied for 7th in number of games played. And despite that, he was 2nd on the team in home runs. So, yeah, good year for him for sure. And, I mean, he showed that he is growing as a player. And it would have been nice to see him at Ichigun. I'm going to pick a guy that made it up to Ichigun and actually ends up falling just a few percentage points shy of being a Triple Crown winner on the farm. Which, I don't know. You can take that for what it's worth. I mean, it's amazing, but at the same time, it's the farm. And that would be Naomasa Yokawa, who batted 301 with 14 home runs and 62 RBIs and two stolen bases. His slugging percentage was just a tick over Perez's, 529. His on-base percentage was lower at 357, but definitely a kid that we hope will make it up to the big club and stay there. Just as a side note, the last guy to win the double crown for the Tigers on the farm was a guy named Issei Morita, and that was in 2013, so really not too long ago. And who? Exactly.
Right.
This kid is not even in baseball anymore. The last I heard, he's in America studying English. So, Yokawa winning that doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean that he's going to be a star at Ichigun at any point, but we certainly hope he will. Next award is Surprise Player of the Year, who, this is not quite a most improved player. I think it's more like who surprised you as far as like, whoa, where did this guy come from? Or we weren't expecting these kind of numbers, or we weren't expecting you to play at all. And there's a lot of candidates, you know, given the way that the team, worked this year, where we had so many call-ups and we had a lot of young guys that got a lot of regular playing time. We could choose from any number of guys. But, Joe, who you got for us?
All right. I am going to go with Haraguchi. So, absolutely, to go from an Ikusei player to a starting catcher for the team and to be in the top three for batting for the entire team, it just fills a major hole we've had, on the team for the last couple of years. We've always had, catchers, but they always weren't the best best at batting. So I really think, it was definitely kind of a surprise to bring him up.
To say the least,
Yeah, and then to perform the way he has and really turn into a solid player. I think that's my surprise player of the year.
Well, you can't go wrong with that pick. You know, when you are a development player, and I remember when they took him off of development status and they brought him up to the first team right away, I was like, I don't know if he's going to last on the first team, but he never got sent
down. They didn't
down
have his jersey ready, right? Or something like that?
They were using special jerseys at the time. But even if it had been regular jersey, I don't think they had his jersey ready because he was triple digits as a development player until they switched his contract. And so, yeah, he used the coach's jersey for his first couple games. And I remember when he got player of the month and he batted 380 or something like that, I had said it would be great if he ends the year batting around 300. We can't expect this kind of production from him the whole year. Sure enough, 299 is his final average. So pretty close to what I was expecting to have happen, but still very impressive numbers. You know, the 11 home runs, you could count Tsuruoka, Fuji, probably even Umeno for the past two seasons, combine all of their home runs and we still can get 11. So good stuff. And, interestingly, I think we started the year hoping that Umeno would find his 2014 form and that he could be the catcher of the future. Little did we know we had an even better catcher of the future, in the development system. So great surprise there. I am going to just purposely go with somebody else just because it's fun to have a couple of guys in here. I'm going to say Yuta Iwasada. And a big reason is he was the first round draft pick in the 2013 draft. But he was not our original top choice. We wanted to get Daichi Osera, but that fell through when we lost the draw. And Iwasada in year one got one win, and in year two got one win. And it didn't look like he was going to pan out as a first-round draft pick. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, bam, he started April and May just outstanding. And then he finished this year, again, his September with September and then October 1st with five starts and five wins and an ERA of under 0.5. And he leads the team in ERA this year. He finishes with 10 wins, easily the best pitcher in the Central League outside of maybe Sugano, especially if you take away his June, July.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, wait, Chris Johnson was pretty good too. Anyways, but still, that's a big surprise because we really thought our aces were either Fujinami or Messenger, and that's all we got. And all of a sudden, Iwasada comes in and is unbelievable and made us forget about Fujinami a little bit, although he was frustrating to watch. So speaking of frustrating to watch, Disappointment of the Year is the next award that we are going to give. And, that could easily go to Fujinami because, you expect great things from him. And after the season he had last year, finishing with 199 innings pitched and leading the Central in strikeouts, and going into his fourth year, you expect him to get better and better, but he didn't. But there were guys that were even bigger disappointments than that, right, Joe?
Absolutely. I've got to give mine to Kyuji Fujikawa. Aww. I had such high hopes for him coming back.
Yes.
As such a, you know, a mainstay of my time when I was in Japan watching him. I was super excited to see him come back to his former team and to hopefully his former glory. But that was short-lived when his starts as a starting pitcher didn't go well in the beginning of the season.
They didn't.
And then kind of got put, I don't know, nowhere. Nowhere really does he fit in into the team. So it was just a tough season to watch every time he came up to throw the ball. So
he got my player of the, or the pitcher of the month one of these months because he did have one really solid month in the bullpen. But this was also a pitcher that I chose as a key player of the year for the Tigers, that if he could, you know, make his set his place in the rotation, that we would have the best rotation in the Central and a better chance of winning the pennant. Ha! That did not work out. So yeah, definitely disappointed in QG. And like I said in last week's show, it would be great for him to be a pitching coach slash, well, player coach on the farm all year next year and ride things out into the sunset and have his retirement game next year and all the tears can flow then. But my disappointment of the year is going to a different pitcher, and that would be Minoru Iwata. This is a guy that, if you don't know, he's got, I think it's type A or type 1 diabetes. I forget if they do letters or numbers. Anyhow, he's been battling this for years, but he's also been an anchor of our pitching rotation, of our starters, for a number of years. Never gets the run support, but always seems to be very consistent. You know, his ERA around the three level, plus or minus a little bit. Good to go 7 innings. You know, good to get into some jams, but always tough in the jams. And this year, he lasted a month, and then he was sent down to the farm, and he only made it back at the start of September. He got called up for, I'm not sure what reason, pitched in a couple games and stank even worse as a reliever than he did as a starter. And that was it. So that's a big disappointment to me. I mean, that's another guy we were counting on for, you know, to eat 160 innings or more and, you know, get us possibly double digits in wins. And he got us no wins and I think maybe 30 innings. So
yikes.
Big time. Yeah. All right. Let's do a little bit of happy stuff here. The play of the year. What was the most exciting play of the year? And that's really hard because, you know, 143 games and so many plays to choose from. So, and not all of them were exciting, mind you. But I'm going to go with game one. And we're looking at Randy Messenger stealing second base. I don't know about you, Joe, but when I watched game one, by the way, the Tigers lost that one 5-2. That was still the most exciting ball I'd seen in such a long time. And one of the signs of great things to come, or so I thought, was Randy Messenger stealing second, showing great alertness. Nobody was covering second. He actually made it to third on the play because the throw from the catcher was caught by no one. But to me, that was just, that was it. Game one, our pitcher steals the base. I think it was the first one in, might have been 50 years by a pitcher or 40 years by a pitcher or something. So it was just like amazing to me. I couldn't have been more excited about the season. But yeah.
Yep.
How about you, Joe? What was your play of the year?
Well, mine was another play that hasn't happened in a couple of years. So I'm going to go, after sitting for I don't know how long trying to think of one play to call it the play of the year, but I am going to go with Takayama's grand slam on August 25th. So the first for the team in over 2 years.
Oh my gosh. So. Yeah, that was really exciting as well. And, I'm the kind of guy that gets pretty optimistic, and maybe every baseball fan does, but every time we got bases loaded and one of our guys that has the potential to hit a home run is up, I'm thinking, I hope we get a grand slam. I hope this guy hits it over the fence. And for 2 years, it didn't happen.
Yeah, well, yeah, I bet you money our batting average was probably, you know, even worse when we had bases loaded than we had runners on, you know, second or third. You know, when the bases get loaded, we just decide to screw it up royally this year. So to actually have it happen.
Yeah, I don't know if it's
good.
The jitters or what, but yeah, I mean, this was the first time that we, like you said, at first time in 2 years, the last guy to do it is now with the Hiroshima Carp tearing it up there, Takahiro Arai. But I was in a hospital bed watching this game, so it wasn't the most exciting of times for me, but watching it certainly got my spirits up. So yeah, good call on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on the flip side of that, let's go back to the negative side and choose the error of the year, Joe. And I mean, we had 96 errors on the season, so there's lots to choose from. We couldn't pour through all the video to decide, but the one that stuck in my mind the most was on, I believe it was June the 26th, and this was against the Hiroshima Carp in Hiroshima. And at this point, we're coming out of interleague play, and we lost the first two games of this series. And we had a chance to win it, which would have put the season series, I think, 5 games for us and 6 for them at this point, if we had won this one. However, on a Rafael Dolis 2 outs pitch, a pop fly to left center, defensive replacement Shunsuke in left, and a stellar center fielder, he had made great plays up until this point in this game, Nakatani, collide, the ball drops, 2 runs score, walk-off loss for the Tigers, and the most humiliating play, I find, of the year. That, I think, gave the Carp a huge amount of confidence, which they already had enough of. It definitely deflated us. Right. And it also lost me a follower on Twitter, the Carp follower who was on one of the shows earlier in the season, Stuart Miller. He was talking about how great of a... He was like, this is so great, this is amazing. And I was like, we carted Shunsuke off on a stretcher and you're gloating about victory on a play that junior high school guys should have made? That's totally classless, dude. And then he blocked me on Twitter. Anyways, that's my error of the year. The second error of the year would be Stuart Miller blocking me. But anyways, Joe, what about you? Who you got? What you got?
You know, I did just as much time thinking through this one for the that I did as the play of the year. But in the end, I really couldn't come up with anything other than the probably 15 that weren't counted as errors against the captain as the errors of the year.
Yeah, there were a ton of those for sure. And I don't remember if this was called an error. I think it was. But even if you look at some of the captain's errors, you know, the errors that he made were not they were not human errors. I mean, they were like superhuman errors, you know. Even this past week, we talked about the dribbler that went through his legs. Right. There was another infield pop fly where, yeah, he dropped it. Yeah. And then the one that got me that I think they did call an error was another one that I think cost us a game, and that was against the Bay Stars. It was a pop fly that was just past him, so he had to kind of backtrack a little bit, but he had plenty of time to do it. And then he tripped, and the ball popped out of his glove. I don't know if you remember that. But that was another humiliating.
Watch out for the grass.
So.
Yeah, I just couldn't pick one out individually, but there was too many for a captain of a team, if you ask me.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially somebody that's on such an Ironman streak. And, you know, we could harp about this all day, and I probably could anyways. You know, Ironman streaks are meant for players that play well. You know, that are durable, but that play well. But if you suck, you shouldn't be on any Ironman streak. You should be on a bench streak. So... yeah, that's that. But yeah, certainly he got more than his share of calls, you know, as far as mercy went. And they didn't call them errors. They called them hits, even though they should have been errors. So good call on that one, Joe. Thanks for bringing that back to our attention and sticking that in our memories. All right, back to the positive side. We're going positive, negative all the way here, it seems. Most exciting game of the year. And this one, I actually have several candidates for, and I found it tough to narrow down. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I mean, it was a tough thing to think back to a single game, but I came up with the April 22nd game against the Carp at Zoom Zoom Stadium with Randy on the mound. We ended up winning the game 12-9 Tigers. We had 19 hits and an obscene amount of offense. Takayama went 4-for-6. Toritani had a 3-run homer, and Yamato had a Moto show, and everybody else on the team just cranking up hits. So I put that as the most exciting game. It's kind of back and forth on the score. You know, we gave up 9 runs, but ended up winning 12-9. Definitely an exciting game to see that amount of offense
happen. Yeah, but we were actually did not give up the lead except for in the bottom of the first. So we started that one with 3 runs in the top of the first. They got 4 right back on us against Messenger in the bottom of the first. And it was looking really shaky, but we got 4 more the very next inning and then 2 more the next inning. And it was not even a question after that. But yeah, I love looking at the Tigers website and looking at their score sheet on this one because they highlight the hits in yellows. And I've never seen so much yellow on a Tigers score sheet than that. You know, like you said, 19 hits. But, you know, let's not fool ourselves. We also committed 2 errors in this one. So, you know, true to form there. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, great choice. I'm going to go through a couple of my honorable mentions before we get to my choice. And the first one is game one of the season. And I already mentioned it, you know, to me, that was just an extremely exciting game from start to finish, even though we lost. Takayama's first career hit, Yokota's first stolen base, a bunch of other exciting moments as well. Another one would be the opening day at Koshien on April the 8th, where Tsuyoshi hit the walk-off hit to right field and dove into Kanemoto's arms after you know, during the celebration. And then his speech was a very moving one as well, talking about how I've caused this team so much trouble by being injured so much. Fast forward 3 months and he's back on the show. Mm-hmm. But very exciting game and a great way to start the season at Koshien. Unfortunately, we could not keep it up at all and stank the whole year in that stadium. Another couple that I would like to mention, a 9-0 win at Koshien. I think it was on July the 26th. And we got all of our runs in one inning. So a 9-run inning in that one. It was really exciting. And I believe Nomi went the distance, complete game shutout in that one. So really cool stuff there. The very next day, we won 10-5. I was at that one. The Blue Goat was on the mound. And Gomez hit two home runs, his first and only time ever hitting two in the same game. But that was really exciting as well. 10-5 win there. But my winner is going to be May the 1st at Koshien Stadium when we faced the playoff-bound DeNA Bay Stars. We really definitely had their number this season. And in this one, we were down 6-1. And that was heading into the seventh inning. But in the bottom of the seventh, we got 5 runs to tie it up. I think that was against Zagurski, their reliever. And so that was just a lot of fun. Part of it was Yamaguchi, part of it was Zagurski. But anyways, it was a lot of fun to see us just tearing them up. And then the very next inning, bottom of the eighth, we got the go-ahead run, and we won the game. So just seeing all that hitting late in the game and showing tenacity was great. And I thought, because the Tigers still had a good record at this point, I thought this is a sign of things to come. We're going to have a great season here. But really, after Interleague, it just fell apart. So that was kind of unfortunate. Right. So let's go back to the negative and the wacky Tomoaki decision of the year.
Yeah, and I would say there weren't too many of these this year in reality.
Yeah, you could really pick at some things, and most of the things that you could pick at are definitely things in retrospect. Why did you put Kyuji in that situation? Why did you not pull the pitcher at this point? Why did you use this guy as a pinch hitter? But those are such small things that really you can't pick at, because sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. But there were definitely some that you would say this was a conscious decision that was stupid. So what was yours?
Yeah, and I'm going with one of those, absolutely conscious decision, and that it was on July the 8th with somebody getting a 161 pitch count with no chance at winning a game. Fujinami's 161 pitches is my wacky Tomoaki of the year.
And we mentioned this in that podcast episode, I remember, but every time the cameras went to Kanemoto between pitches or whatever, I mean, he just looked as somber as I've ever seen him. And I don't know if they put an extra filter or lens on the camera, but he looked like he was definitely in the shadows. I mean, he looked like a really pissed off, detective or like a murder suspect or something, man. I mean, it was crazy. I couldn't believe it. So good call on that one. I'm going to go with a different one though, because that makes things a lot more fun. This was earlier, actually a month ago to the date, September 2nd, we are down, 3-0 against DeNA. And again, if we can win some of these games against DeNA, we're chipping away at their lead and we're giving ourselves a chance at the playoffs. We're down 3-0 and we get back-to-back solo home runs. So it is 3-2 and our next guy singles. So we've gotten 3 straight hits, including 2 big boppers against their pitcher. But we need to tie the game, right, instead of continuing the rally. So let's bunt and get him, the guy over to score into scoring position and give their pitcher a free out. So that was a very Wada-esque wacky Tomoaki right there. Mm-hmm. And we did not score that runner from second base. We did not win the game. And yeah, it's easy to say in retrospect, but I was saying it right at the very moment they called it. Don't bunt. The other one that I would say is that they were so, Tomoaki was so patient with Toritani, and that includes his fielding errors and his hitting woes, but they were so impatient with Haig. And I know Toritani's got, you know, a good track record and Haig doesn't, but it's just a huge contrast. So, but we'll save that one. So let's go with the opposite side of this, the best manager decision of the year.
All right. I think this one, you know, it's kind of hard, again, to pick kind of a single thing that, you know, oh, he did right here, you know. But I think we both can agree that Todytani's ending of his consecutive inning streak was probably the best decision of the year. We were waiting for it for a long time.
Yes. Yes, indeed. I mean, we talked about it on the show. I wrote about it on my website. We chatted about it on Hanshin Tigers game day page. What's wrong here? Why do we keep putting him in? And then finally, it was July the 24th. And who did we start at shortstop? Yamato. And eventually that ended up becoming Hojo at shortstop for the bulk of the season. Great decision, Tomoaki. Great decision. And let's put an end to the other Iron Man streak soon. The thing is, Toritani, I think, is like 14 games from passing Kanemoto. Not full innings, but the consecutive game streak. I think he's 14 games away. So, I mean, it would take a lot of cojones for Kanemoto to stop the streak at 13 or something like that. Like, just one away. I'd love to see it, but I don't think it's going to happen. So, all right. The last one that I want to talk about, and this is one that maybe is a little bit more personal on my side of things, and that is the game day, Hanshin Tigers game day, and H10 fans of the year. People that showed true commitment to the team from start to finish on the season, both with making comments, with posting stuff, with just being an integral part of what we do here at H10. And my two winners are going to be Pete Duffy. Love the guy. I mean, he's commenting on all of what I do. You know, he comments on my Twitter stuff. He comments on the game day stuff. He comments on the Hanshin Tiger stuff. Oh, another guy, Tsuyoshi Furusawa. Sorry. Usually I'm better at last names. I don't know him personally. I've never actually talked with him, but he constantly wrote comments after games. I'm guessing he's a working man. He gets home, he watches highlights or he watches the game, and his comments always came through at like 1 a.m. or something like that, but just constant. And I mean, I give him props because I'm guessing Japanese is his first language, but he's still on the page writing comments in English, and I thought that was solid. But the absolute winner, it's got to be hands down, Joe. I think everybody knows this, right? And I'm sorry, I wish I could pronounce her name perfectly, but I don't know what the Swedish pronunciation would be, but Therese Carlson. She posted the lineups probably more than half of the games. Partway through the season, I asked her if she would help take over, and she did more than take over. She posted links to, you know, game streams. She was posting articles with brief summaries, highlights, hero interviews, the whole nine yards and beyond. So thank you so much. I almost feel like it's yours. I almost feel like game day is your page now, Therese. But great job. Super fan, especially for someone that's not even in Japan anymore. My understanding is she was studying in Kyoto for a while, but now she's back in Sweden. So excellent. Loved following the Tigers with her, with Pete, with Tsuyoshi, and with, you know, all the other guys that commented regularly during game day. Sanjay came along this year for the first time. Doug Frigland, I think he's a new fan to NPB and maybe even baseball. He's a British guy. And then James Brown, who used to be here and is now back in the UK. I love these fans that are overseas, and that includes you, Joe, who are just so committed to following the Tigers, watching games, stuff like that. So there you have it. That's the fans of the year. Joe, you are not included in that because I go beyond fan with you because you've been co-host, and that's just absolutely super. So much appreciated. All right, well, next we are going to hear our final comments. We haven't done this in a long time, ladies and gentlemen, so I'm sure you missed them a lot. We've got Jimbo, we got Zorny, and yeah, the same old T-Ray voice, but we're going to do the fantasy update.
What's up, H10 fans? Jimbo here, the Eternal Cellar Dweller, to give you your final update for Hanshin Tigers Fantasy Baseball. Looking back at my draft class, I would say if I had to do it all over again, I probably would only choose one guy from my squad. That would be Randy Messenger, who was a workhorse and got it done day in and day out. My number two draft, I'm sure everyone forgot by now. Fortunately, I can never forget, was Matt Haig. We'll all think back to when I drafted him. He was playing really well. He got a couple home runs, a couple he was doing really well at the beginning of the season. Well, maybe not a couple home runs. Maybe that's looking back with rose-colored glasses. But he was playing really well at the beginning of the season before he just dropped off the face of the earth and did nothing ever again. Yeah, he did a couple things down on the farm team, but not good enough for my fantasy. My third draft pick, Iwata, yeah, he's almost exactly like Haig, except he never played well. Went down to the farm and disappeared. Then you keep going down the list, and went down to the farm, disappeared. Went down to the farm, disappeared. Team captain did nothing but walk all year, which we don't really count in this fantasy. Imanardi, nothing. Next guy, nothing. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I, my team needed a better manager, which has been kind of the Tiger story for since, what, 2005? And even then, with Okada, he wasn't very good. So I guess I did really well in regards to the Tigers. But, yeah, I'm at the bottom, always at the bottom. Zorny, T-Ray, hats off to you guys. You guys knew what to do. You knew how to draft them. But I guess I just feel like most Tigers fans when I say, I'm glad it's finally over. Let's look forward to next season, huh? I'll see you guys there. I'll still be here. I'm not going anywhere. I love my fantasy. And I hope to see more guys coming out so we can take down T-Ray, the king of the mountain.
Don't you want it? Don't you need it? Your fantasy. Tiger's fantasy.
Hey everyone, it's your boy Zorny here, and this time for my last fantasy update of the season. Not the end of the season that we all wanted, but at least the beginning of a bright future. At least that's what I hope for. From my draft class, I would like to highlight two players that I have that have a promising future ahead, and they are Hojo and Takayama. After Merton left the Tigers, we couldn't ask for a better replacement to take the position in left field. He already broke the record for most hits in a single season for a rookie, and even has the same number 9 on the back of his jersey. It seems that Hojo is going to be our full-time shortstop after a very disappointing run by Toritani, and actually I have no idea what's going to happen. To Toritani. To wrap everything up, I would like to say that it was a lot of fun to be part of this fantasy league, and if it wasn't for this, probably the season would be way more tough to watch. If you're listening right now to me, I encourage you to participate on the next one. It's a lot of fun. You're not going to regret it. Now it's time for me to enjoy my second place award and to start a new strategy to beat the man, T-Ray. All the props to you, buddy. Congratulations. Thank you both, T-Ray and Jimbo, for a great time, and see you guys next year. Bye-bye.
Hey, everybody. This is T-Ray talking to you about Fantasy H10 Fantasy 2016. So this was kind of a landslide victory for me, and I don't really want to gloat about that, but I will talk a bit about my strategy and how I chose and why I chose. So one of the things that characterized my team was that I definitely had stronger farm numbers than my friends, and that was maybe because I knew the players better. So if you look at some of my picks, like fourth round, I got Yokawa, who did terrible on the Ichigun team, but killed it on the farm. 14 home runs and 62 RBIs and batted .301. So pretty amazing. Uemoto finally came through towards the end on the Ichigun team, but he was pretty good down at Nigun. And then I've got Nelson Perez, who did very well at Nigun as well. So Araki stole a bunch of bases at Nigun. Akiyama got 9 wins at Nigun. Ogata had a decent balance at Nigun, and thankfully, my number 17 pick, Ryota Arai, played more at Nigun than he did at Ichigun, and he actually did a decent job there as well. So, on the whole, pretty good stuff. Even my final pick, Ryoma Matsuda, did really well at the end. 27 innings pitched and only 3 earned runs on the big squad. So, I think from top to bottom, I really didn't have any terrible picks. I mean, Shimamoto was not a great pick, so I dropped him, but he did all right in the end. Iwamoto was hurt a lot. Kai Ueda, if I had kept him, I would have gotten 10 extra stolen bases, because after I dropped him, he started to rock and roll. Let's see. I guess Fujinami, I kind of regret picking him first overall, but at the time, you know, you really can't go with anybody else. And I remember when we did the fantasy draft, Zorni and Jimbo, you may remember this, when I said Fujinami with the first pick, both of you kind of groaned like, ah, that's who I was going to pick. So if it hadn't been me, it would have been you. In the end, we had some good times. I really enjoyed hearing your guys' updates. I really enjoyed updating the stats and checking the most recent scores with you all throughout the year. So it was a good time. So hopefully next year we can do something like this again. And try and take me down. Try your best. All right, thanks, guys. It was a great season, and I am sorry that I had to pummel you so thoroughly, and I won first place. But that's the way she goes. I mean, when you follow the Tigers as closely as I do, I mean, it's kind of expected that I'm going to be the one to pick the best guys, and that's what happened. Well, we are going to wrap things up, Joe. As I mentioned last week, this is the final episode of the season, and you know, you heard last week my baby was crying, and you know, it's just a little bit more challenging now as a parent of two very young kids, to find the time to do a podcast, mix it, post it, all that kind of stuff. And since it is off season, we're going to wait probably until February or March of next year to do our next episode. So that gives everybody a good break from listening to my voice. Unfortunately, you don't get to hear Joe's voice either for a good amount of time, but I just want to send out some thankses, especially because this is episode 50, a nice round number. So I want to go through some of the people that co-hosted with me, that guested on the show. First, and I shouldn't say foremost, but in a sense foremost, would be Wizzo, because he started this with me. He was my co-host from the beginning, and of the first 23 episodes, he co-hosted he co-hosted 16. So that was really solid. It was a good way to get the show up and running and get some listenership. And then Joe, you were able to take over, and of the last 29 episodes, I think you were on 21, if my count is right.
Okay.
So excellent. Yeah, I guess I can go back and count, but we'll say 21 or 29. Excellent. So thanks so much for that. And then guest co-hosts, I had a guy named Michael on episode 3. He was a lot of fun. I've been trying to get him back, but can't. I had Tom Zilla on episode 25. I had James Brown on episode 14. I had Jimbo on episodes 35 through 37. Zorni on episodes 16 and 35. Stephen Green, CEO of Rockcore, also a new father like myself, on episode 27. And then we had guests Patrick Newman, Christian Jin, and we had team experts like Kozo from the Swallows, Stuart, Block Me on Twitter from the Carp, Isaac from the Dragons, Mark from the Bay Stars, and then superfan Peter Gibson on episode 15X. We also had Aki Bubek, up-and-coming musician, on episode 37. By the way, she's about a week away from having her second baby, so an early congrats to Aki and family. And then we've also had ex-Tigers on the show, and I can say now 3 ex-Tigers, although one was a current Tiger when we had him on. That would be Gene Backe, who was on episode 14. He played for the team from 1962 to 68. We had Matt Haig on episode 36, and he played on the team for 2016, or part of it. And then, of course, today's guest, Matt Merton, from 2010 to 2015. Thank you so much to everybody who has been on the H10 show. And if I did not mention you, and if your voice was on the show, I'm really sorry, but I really do appreciate everybody that has been part of this from episode 1 all the way through episode 50. It has been such a blast, and I hope, if all goes well, we'll be back in the spring with episode 51 and beyond. Joe, hope to see you and hear from you then.
All right, sounds good.
Yeah. Well, everybody, have a great winter. Have a great off-season. Stay in touch with us, please. We will be updating the website, thehunchingtigers.com, I'll be on Twitter every now and then doing a little bit of baseball stuff, but maybe not so much, at the Hanshin Tiger. And then the Facebook page, Hanshin Tigers English News, will be there. I'll be posting stuff there. My website stuff automatically gets sent there. So stick with us. It's going to be a fun off season. We've had lots of cuts. We're going to have lots more cuts. We're going to have lots of drafts and lots of acquisitions. The Hanshin Tigers in 2017, they're going to be even more fun than this year. Have a good one, everybody.
ありがとうって今は言わせて